the two big things that can really help relieve premenstrual irritability and symptoms like that are progesterone and vitamin B6, and they both help to reduce histamine in the body.
Welcome to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. The show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. We're Dr. Haley Knight and Kristen Cornett, your hosts and the creators of the online fertility platform, Tiny Feet. Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. We're so glad you're here, and oh man, are you in for a good episode today. We asked Dr. Laura Bryden, author of the Period Repair Manual, to come back on the podcast so we can talk all about this interesting topic of histamine and the estrogen connection. But first, before we dive into what you're going to learn, we have some very exciting news. So on Monday, September 23rd, 2019, we officially released our brand new online course called Fertile in 5 Masterclass. This course is a comprehensive 5-step program that we designed to help you get pregnant naturally, stay pregnant, and safely bring your healthy baby home. So if you're looking to feel empowered and confident in your fertility journey, this course is definitely for you. So we've taken absolutely everything that we know and have talked about on the podcast in this last year, and we put it in this easy to follow 5-step guide. So the course materials include hours of video lessons, quick reference guides, a recipe book, and links to all of our favorite resources. And if you want to get a little preview of what to expect in the course, go join our free course called How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements. This is a preview of module 3 out of 5 in the brand new course. The link is in the podcast description notes, so go pause the podcast and join the free course right now. Did you get it? Awesome. Okay, really quick, what I'm most excited about with the new course release are the bonuses. We added 3 awesome bonuses in addition to all of the core material. So these bonuses include the right way to track your menstrual cycle so you can get pregnant faster, genetic SNP testing 101, which lists out all of the SNPs that we recommend testing for, why you want to test for them, and then the best resources on how to get tested. And lastly, how to do an elimination diet the right way so you get results. And we also have 2 additional bonuses that are only available for the next week during this special release period. And these 2 bonuses are absolutely my favorite of all of the material that we created. So the first one is 7 supplements that improve egg and sperm quality, which includes brands we love and also the dosing. So this is a 20-minute video by Moi. So it's a video lesson where I walk you through each of those specific supplements. And then my favorite bonus is a downloadable reference handout called Optimal Lab Values for Fertility. Now, this is a comprehensive document that includes all the lab tests recommended for men and women, why they're important, and optimal lab ranges for each test. This also includes sperm analysis lab values. So absolutely love this because I use it in my practice all the time with my patients. And now we're just going to give it to you during this special release period. So these 2 will only be available until October 2nd. So if you're feeling inspired and want to learn more, then click on the Fertile in 5 link in the podcast description notes. Lastly, if you invest in this program before the end of day on Wednesday, October 2nd, you can get $100 off the course by using the promotional code LASTCHANCE. So one more time, if you get in on this brand new Fertile in 5 course by October 2nd, you'll get $100 off the course by entering the promo code LASTCHANCE. So if you didn't catch that, no worries, we'll have it in the episode description for you. All right, on to today's episode. You're listening to episode 47, where we interview naturopathic doctor, women's health expert, and author of the Period Repair Manual, Dr. Laura Bryden. She's informed by a strong science background and more than 20 years with patients. Laura is a passionate communicator about women's health and alternatives to hormonal birth control. Her book, Period Repair Manual, is a manifesto of natural treatment for better hormones and better periods, and provides practical solutions using nutrition, supplements, and natural hormones. Now in its second edition, the book has been an underground sensation and has worked to quietly change the lives of tens of thousands of women. So we're very excited to have her back on the podcast. If you haven't listened to episode 24 yet, please go check it out. Dr. Bryden clears up the confusion around PCOS diagnosis, which is another topic she is extremely well-versed in. So in this episode, we wanted to share her knowledge about this very interesting connection between our sex hormones, especially estrogen, and histamine. So when you hear the word histamine, you're probably immediately thinking of an allergic reaction or response like hives or a runny nose, and using antihistamines for these type of allergies. But histamine actually participates in a lot of other functions in the body, including our digestion, sleep, and our menstrual cycles. So we need histamine, but having too much of it can really cause problems like heavy or painful periods, PMS or even PMDD, menstrual migraines, and cyclic hives, to name just a few. So in this episode with Dr. Bryden, you're going to learn what histamine is and how it relates to your menstrual cycle, the dairy and histamine connection, how controlling histamine can help with PMS and PMDD relief, and how to start healing from histamine intolerance. Also, throughout the episode, you'll hear that Kristen has a personal experience with histamine, so listen for her insight as well. We hope you enjoy the interview.
All right, welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Laura Bryden. We are so happy to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me, you guys.
Absolutely. This is going to be hopefully a fun topic, maybe a little more sciencey today. But this is an interesting one because I think a lot of women haven't heard of this connection that we're going to be discussing between hormones and the menstrual cycle and fertility and this weird little molecule that we know as histamine. So let's talk a little bit first about what histamine is. So most people, if they've heard of histamine, they're thinking of it more in the context of like allergic reactions, like if you have to take an antihistamine for allergies or something. But histamine does quite a few more things in the body for us than just cause allergic reactions. So why don't you talk about a little bit about what histamine is and some of its other functions?
Yeah. Well, I was just kind of fact checking this before we started. I think it's got like dozens of functions in the body. So we'll talk about a few of them.
Right.
It's like many things in the body, they multitask, right? You know, there's one thing, it was invented or evolved for a certain purpose. It's like, oh, but we can also use it for this and we can use it for this. And it just gets into everything. So histamine is a good example of that. And to discuss histamine, we really need to discuss the cell that makes, one of the cells that makes histamine, which is called the mast cell. This is probably one of the most important parts of the conversation. Is the mast cell is part of the immune system, and it releases a bunch of things, of which histamine is one. So histamine is the most well-known part of that. Yes, as you say, it's part of the allergic response. It makes blood vessels more leaky. It puts fluid everywhere. It mounts a inflammatory response against various things. So it's actually extremely important for part of the immune system, but it also, histamine and other mediators that are released from mast cells do lots of other things. So histamine is also a neurotransmitter. This is a big one, actually. It affects the brain. It stimulates the brain. It can cause irritability. It's also involved in the sleep-wake cycle. So histamine is a big factor in insomnia, kind of overstimulation, hyperarousal, which is why the old school type of sleeping tablets are antihistamines. That's how they work.
Oh, right. Histamine. And when Benadryl makes you sleepy.
Exactly. Histamine is also involved, just to give a sampling, it stimulates the release of stomach acid, which is actually an important thing for it to do. It's involved in the hormonal system, particularly in the female hormonal system and in the function of the uterus. So we'll unpack a little bit about that, but just suffice it to say that, here's an example just to get us started. Histamine stimulates libido, which is why antihistamines have the side effect of low libido or, you know, problems orgasming or dryness, just for example.
Very interesting.
And also potentially histamine is involved in the signaling involved in ovulation.
Okay. So let's go that direction.
In the direction of ovulation.
So let's talk about histamine's role in the menstrual cycle. So it influences ovulation, but it also influences like that whole hormone dance that kind of leads up to ovulation and your menstrual cycle. So how is histamine involved in all of that?
Yeah, the short answer is I don't think scientists even know exactly its role in every part of it, because we've only really started researching the menstrual cycle in the last few decades, you know, even understanding any of the ins and outs of it, which I just think is interesting because I've heard the point made a few times that the pill and hormonal birth control was invented before anyone really understood much about the menstrual cycle at all. So this is, we're kind of in new territory with some of this, but.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So we do know that what I know and what I think was known from the research, we know that histamine is involved in signaling ovulation. We know that histamine stimulates estrogen release, which is interesting because also estrogen stimulates histamine release. So there is one of the important things to understand, one of the takeaways from our conversation today is there's a feed forward kind of vicious cycle between estrogen and histamine. So when your estrogen starts to go up, you can get a histamine release, which is why some women can get symptoms leading up to ovulation. When estrogen peaks, you can get, you know, headaches or kind of nasal congestion or irritability. That we talk about that as, I hear that talked about a lot as estrogen dominance, but I'm now in the camp where I think a lot of the symptoms we attribute to estrogen dominance are actually mast cell or histamine symptoms.
Wow. That's super fascinating. So yeah. I got to give a little context here about this episode.
Yeah.
So I am a sufferer of the histamine response or the kind of hyperactive histamine response. And what I find really interesting is kind of what you're talking about how symptoms change throughout the menstrual cycle in response to what your hormones are doing.
Yeah.
And my history, especially in the luteal phase, is kind of low progesterone in relationship to estrogen. And so I noticed the worst symptoms where I'm at right now in my cycle, actually, which is about halfway through that luteal phase when estrogen kind of starts to do its little, you know, rise again. And if progesterone isn't higher than estrogen at that point, I feel like my symptoms are quite a bit worse. So
yeah,
I'm going to bring that up. That's why we wanted to talk about this, because I'm all passionate about it and learning more right now.
Well, let's go from there. So in general, there's always an exception with the body, but in general, progesterone has an antihistamine effect in that progesterone upregulates something called DAO enzyme in the gut that helps to excrete histamine from the body. And also progesterone can in general stabilize mast cells, but it can do the opposite in some women. So this is where it gets tricky. So I certainly have had some women who report that progesterone can give them a bit of a histamine response too. So that makes it harder. But I'd say for most women, progesterone has an antihistamine effect, which is why, again, going back to, you know, what works for women's health, I'm also at the point where I'm thinking the two big things that can really help relieve premenstrual irritability and symptoms like that are progesterone and vitamin B6, and they both help to reduce histamine in the body. So I think that's one of their mechanisms of why they help with premenstrual type symptoms.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because we have these nutrients that we know like clinically are really helpful. Yeah. And so it's really fun to learn more about the mechanism of action behind why some of those things work so well.
So vitamin B6 also upregulates that enzyme in the gut that clears histamine. But to be fair, vitamin B6 does a lot of things. So it's
hundreds of things. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's more going on. But just to bring in, because we're talking about the gut a little bit here, right? And clearing histamine through the gut. I mean, the body clears histamine other ways as well. But Here's the tricky thing, and some of your listeners probably already know this. In addition to the histamine that we make, that the mast cells release, and they are sometimes releasing way more than they should be, there are histamine and histamine-like things in foods, right? Mm-hmm. So we can get from what's good about the mast cell histamine discussion from a natural health perspective is there's a lot you can do with diet. So you can, if you're in that territory where you have a very mast cell histamine type picture, you can actually make quite dramatic differences by changing the diet, both by reducing foods that contain histamine, and also I would say at this point early in the conversation, while people are still able to absorb information, one of the things that can make a big difference is to remove foods that stimulate mast cells or activate mast cells. And I'm going to just say on the record that actually one of the big ones for a lot of people, not everyone, that is cow's dairy. So the casein of cow's dairy can upset the mast cells in a lot of people. And this is one of the reasons I think removing cow's dairy can be so helpful for some things, such as PMS, or severe PMS, hormonal headaches, but also heavy periods. Now, I want to talk about this for a second because, you know, I've known for a long time that removing dairy for some people can lighten periods. I've definitely seen that clinical picture where the kind of mast cell histamine-y people are tending to heavy periods sometimes. And one thing I've recently learned from Tanya Dempsey, and she's got a scientific paper about this, so I don't know if you know her, you could have her on your podcast sometime. Dr. Tanya Dempsey, we'll put this in the show notes. But I heard her explain, and then they've now published a paper about this, that there are a lot of mast cells present in the uterine lining. And they release, you know, they're involved with the shedding of the lining, certainly, and probably, you know, other things as well in terms of fertilization and in terms of fertility. There's probably a lot going on with mast cells. Implantation is an immune event.
Yes.
Right? It's an immune event, not more than a hormonal event. So that's a part of fertility that, you know, often needs to be explored. But what she pointed out is that there are a lot of mast cells in the uterine lining. They release histamine, and they also, one of the other many mediators or chemical mediators that they release is heparin, which is a blood thinner, which increases blood flow. As soon as I heard her say that, I just,
wow.
Yes, that makes so much sense. That makes sense why removing dairy can lighten periods, why giving turmeric can lighten periods, because it's a mast cell stabilizer. Her paper is, we'll put it in the show notes, but they're using things like giving antihistamines like intravaginally, putting antihistamine pessaries and things like that to treat these women with supposedly unexplained heavy periods. So yeah,
it's an interesting
topic. Yeah.
We're definitely going to have to go research her
deeper. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I hope that's making some things clear.
Well, so there's like heavy periods, potentially even painful periods, and some issues with estrogen. So, but there are some other things that histamine can be involved with that are kind of specific to like menstrual cycle issues and fertility. So you kind of list off some of the things, like what might a woman notice if she's kind of overloaded on histamine? How would that manifest in her cycle and symptoms?
Yeah, I guess okay, well, so first of all, I'll just say some of the other conditions that do seem to have a connection with mast cells, I think where mast cells and histamine are big players, would be endometriosis, adenomyosis, menstrual migraines, PMS. I have a blog post called The Role of Mast Cells and Histamine in PMS and PMDD. So I think that's an important aspect of what's going on. It's not the only thing that's going on with those mood changes, but it's a big one in that you take steps to stabilize mast cells, you can usually relieve
a lot of that,
a lot of the symptoms.
Yeah. We just did an episode a couple weeks ago on mental health, and I teased that we were going to have an interview with you on soon, that we were going to kind of cover that connection with PMDD, because I mean, really, I think the science is pointing toward PMDD is this sort of inflammatory type of response, which a lot of mental health type of issues are. And so kind of learning more about that mechanism of action, like where is this coming from? What's contributing to it? I think that's really fascinating. So some of the strategies that we're going to talk about in terms of mitigating that histamine response could be really applicable to women who are suffering from PMDD.
It can. And the nice thing about treating mast cells and histamine, I'll say, is it can work fairly quickly. You know, different treatments and different things we're trying to do to fix period problems. Some of them take a few months to take effect, but this kind of thing, stabilizing histamine, can actually give relief in hours or, days. So that's just a nice thing. So it's one of those things where you can definitely try some treatments just to see how it is and get that immediate feedback from the body, which is great. So, and that's your question about what does, if you have a mast cell or histamine problem, what is that going to feel like or look like throughout the cycle? I guess I would say it's definitely the situation where you are referred already to potentially getting some aggravation of symptoms pre-ovulation, which is not the norm, right? Because most of us feel pretty good before ovulation when estrogen goes up, because estrogen is such a euphoric, I'd almost say, it's a great hormone. It's highly stimulating. I think in my book, In Period to Pair Manual, I talk about estrogen as like the charismatic friend that you love to have around, but at a certain point it's like, leave now.
Enough.
Exactly. The life of the party. But when the life of the party comes in, and there's an underlying problem with mast cells or histamine, suddenly the life of the party is, that's way too much. So overstimulated, irritability potentially. And potentially hot. Okay, the key symptom of, doesn't have to be there, but if there is hives or urticaria, especially on a hormonal menstrual cycle basis, that's a dead giveaway. That's a histamine mast cell response. And I'd say that's better than any kind of lab testing. In terms of lab testing, I know there's some things that are available. They're not great. And actually, as a clinician down under, I don't really have access to those types of testing. So I tend to rely a lot on symptoms and context and trying to get a feel for if histamine's involved. And actually, one of the official diagnostic criteria for mast cell activation syndrome is, does giving antihistamines relieve the symptom? Because I mean, that's a perfectly logical thing. So sometimes I'll say, okay, just try taking an antihistamine through this premenstrual time, and let's just see what the response is. Not that the antihistamine drugs will become part of the permanent treatment program, because there's some problems with that, but at least it's diagnostic. In fact,
it's easy to give you an indication of what you're dealing with rather than, having to go through hundreds or more dollars of like other types of testing. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, and actually, those tests where you can even get given anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen or Advil and just kind of see is this helping you out? Because then that really helps the patient understand this is inflammation and that's why you're feeling this way. And so, it's confirming to them, and it's motivating to them too, of wow, that really fixed my symptoms. Well, of course they're at a naturopathic doctor because they don't want to be on these over-the-counter drugs. And so, but I think it is a good diagnostic type of test to do at home.
Definitely. It gives information. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, because I'm quite interested in the history of medicine. So I think there's a lot that we can learn from just knowing what we used to do, what worked, what didn't work. But one quirky thing, I think it's kind of quirky, is that for decades, antihistamines were the main treatment for PMS. It was a common treatment. It was kind of known that that was a thing that worked. And yet now we are in 2019, still debating whether, histamine plays a role in PMS.
Yeah, I feel like I never knew that.
I know.
I must have been just a baby when they were doing that.
Yeah. I guess. Well, that's always fascinating to me, the way that we used to use something, like we used to rely on a particular type of treatment, and then like fancy drugs or other things come out and we're like, okay, we don't need that anymore. And it's like, we forgot that that's how we used to address it.
Well, now we use antidepressants for PMS. So
yeah, which actually, to be fair, actually, so a lot of the SSRIs do have an antihistamine effect as well. Not all of them.
Really interesting.
Off the top of my head, I don't know which do and which don't, but they're all anti, so some of them are anticholinergic. Or one thing worth pointing out, the antihistamine drugs, you know, there's some concern that using those consistently, like, you know, over decades, is not great for the brain, because it also, you know, can
reduce, because it's a neurotransmitter, because it has so many different roles in the body. You don't want to just like completely suppress it.
And it also suppresses acetylcholine, which is important. So there's some links. There's some links with long-term antihistamine use and risk of dementia, right? So not to, I mean, just to be clear, that doesn't mean if you take a few antihistamines through the month, or I've used it a bit for allergies, that it's just, if you wouldn't want to be on these drugs every day for years and years or decades, that's not potentially good for the brain. So fortunately, there are lots of things we can do from a natural perspective to dial down. There's two goals of treatment: dial down the mast cell activation and dial up or assist with the healthy clearance of histamine through the gut, right? So, and also a lot of the dialing down the mast cell response also includes the gut, because that's where a lot of the mast cells are sitting, is on the gut lining. They're everywhere that's a barrier, right? Like the uterine lining, the gut lining, you know, the mouth and, you know, the nose and bronchioles, that's those mast cells there. They're everywhere where there needs to be a defense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and so adding to that, in terms of symptoms, you know, sinus congestion, post-nasal drip, those are some classic histamine symptoms, or like mucus production in the throat. Like if you eat something and you're like, you know, you're like trying to clear your throat, or you just like feel all mucusy all of a sudden. I actually wonder if that's part of the reason that people say that dairy is mucus forming.
Totally.
Because I don't know if that's really necessarily true in everybody. Like, I don't know if that's scientifically accurate. I think that's more of a, that is not a good food for you to eat. And so if you feel mucusy after you drink milk or eat something containing dairy, that's more likely that you have a sensitivity or you have something going on with histamine.
Yeah, Kristen, I think that's pretty much it. And just like you said, not everyone gets that. So if you're not having a mast cell response to that dairy protein, then you're just like, I don't know what everyone's going on about. Dairy's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine for you, but not for the poor person who's got like, not just mucus, but massive fluid, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting point for the listeners to know, that, you know, it's something that we always recommend: an elimination diet, you know, remove dairy for 4 weeks, add it back in, see what your symptoms are, because just like you said, it's not everybody is sensitive to dairy, where, you know, the whole world doesn't have to be off dairy.
No.
It's just a matter of like, are you having these symptoms that we just listed out? And to really figure it out, you got to do a good elimination diet and then reintroduce it and see what happens.
I might chime in with a little clinical pearl, which you guys can confirm or deny for trying to decide if there's a dairy issue. And we're talking about a casein. I would specify actually an A1 casein, a very specific protein in dairy that is what seems to cause all the immune havoc in some people. What I find with my own patient population and over many decades is I always ask about childhood health. So specifically for dairy, what I'm looking for, I'm asking about, sometimes they're, you know, waiting for them to volunteer. Did they have a problem with recurring, it's kind of one or two things, recurring tonsillitis and or chest infections, or recurring like middle ear infections to the point where you get tubes. You just call them, there you call them tubes in your ears. Like in Australia, they call them grommets. So these like to drain the middle ear when you're a kid. To me, that is, classic. As soon as someone says, oh, yeah, I had, that's dairy. And I don't just mean, oh, you had tonsillitis one time. That's not what I mean. I mean, the ongoing, that is an immune system type. So that's the type of immune system that does not like casein.
Where they remove the tonsils, right? Like, so
yeah, they remove the tonsils. Ongoing and year after year of antibiotics for chest infections. That's dairy. And what happens is kids outgrow that, right? Because the immune system, the changes. This is so suddenly, no, you're no longer getting those recurring tonsillitis by your 20s, but suddenly you're having severe PMS, or you're having something else that's this, a downstream effect from the same kind of casein mast cell, probably broader immune problem potentially from dairy. So,
well, you just described my childhood. So I suffered from chronic ear infections, and right before my parents were going to put tubes in my ears, they stopped, which is kind of interesting. So
yeah,
I didn't have to go through that process, but I've always had problems with my ears. Like forever, I had issues with them, and I assumed that it was like scarring or something from all the infections or something, but then I realized I had a bunch of food sensitivities.
Yeah.
And that was a big, piece of my healing journey.
Well, for the true dairy sensitive person who's been having a lot of immune dysfunction like that, or mast cell, this is one of the things in the interventions that we do that is the most rewarding as a clinician, because people can, like true dairy sensitive people, when they stop cow's dairy, it's like, you know, it's like this kind of like amazing moment where they just, over the next few months, like, oh my goodness, I can't believe how different I feel. Like I've just lost this fluid retention. Suddenly my immune system's working. I'm not all clogged up. And, you know, it feels really amazing. And I want to say something about this, because this might be some of your listeners. My experience now in the last few years, since plant-based diet has become so popular, is that when people, some people, not everyone, but all, sometimes people feel this amazing shift when they go vegan or plant-based. They're like, oh my God, I feel so different. Oh, it must be, yeah, all that animal protein is bad. What they're experiencing a lot of the time is coming off dairy, which can feel amazing. But because I'm not actually, I hope I can say this on here, I'm not a fan of the plant-based diet or vegan diet. I don't know.
You can say that. We had a whole episode about that.
There'll be some listeners going, off.
Oh, that's okay.
No, they already heard about that in episode 17 of the podcast. So if they've been a fan for a while, they know how we feel about that.
We don't recommend a vegan diet when you're trying to get pregnant. And that's been our stance this whole time. So it's okay.
Okay. All right. So my conversations with patients go like this. I'm like, oh, I'm worried about you being vegan. You know, I have serious concerns about the nutrient deficiencies of that. And then the answer will be, yeah, but how can it be bad for me when I felt so amazing when I changed to the diet? I'm like, well, could it be, you know, dairy? And they're like, oh yeah, maybe. I'm like, you know, so you could consider giving back some of the other types of animal proteins, or eating those again, leaving cow's dairy out, but reintroducing hopefully, you know, eggs or chicken or other things that are not going to give you that same inflammatory response. I hope that's been helpful. That's one of my key messages I'm trying to get out there now, actually.
I really like that, because people stay on the plant-based diet because they do feel this amazing first response in the first couple of months, which usually it does take a couple months to get off dairy before your body like has that moment.
Yeah. Yes.
But then they continue on the vegan diet, and pretty soon, 8 months to a year down the road, they're not feeling so great. And usually it's because now they have nutrient deficiencies that they didn't anticipate with the vegan diet. So yeah, I really like that. And hopefully that helps some listeners out if they're considering plant-based, or if they have already been on it for a while.
And then it's like, it's hard to identify that it could be the dietary approach that you're taking when you feel really amazing at first, then these other issues develop later. And they're like, no, it can't be the diet. I felt so good. It's like, well, now you're nutrient. Like using up your B12 stores, for instance, can take months. If you have good B12 stores when you start a vegan diet, it can take a while for you to exhaust those and start to, you know, feel low energy, for instance. So.
The other one that can become, obviously you had a whole podcast about it, so we won't repeat that now. But the other key nutrient that can become deficient over time is vitamin A, preformed vitamin A, which we need for immune function. It was the first vitamin discovered, right?
And our reproductive system.
Yes.
It needs vitamin A or retinol for optimal function.
Babies need vitamin A.
Yes.
Yeah.
They do. And choline.
We talked about, how many was it? It was like 9 different nutrients that we did. That podcast was like one of our longest episodes. We talked for like 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. About all the nutrients and vegan diets.
All right. Okay. Let's moving on. We'll let the, hopefully the vegans haven't turned us off by now. So let's keep going. Yeah.
So let's talk about the gut. So you mentioned the gut as being an important place where histamine is cleared out of the body. And that's because one of the main enzymes that breaks down histamine, which is called diamine oxidase or DAO, is actually produced in the lining of the small intestine. Interestingly enough, a lot of DAO is actually produced by the placenta during pregnancy. So people with histamine issues often feel so much better during pregnancy.
It's true.
Because they're getting a lot more DAO from their placenta. Yep.
Exactly. You get this relief or remission from all these histamine symptoms. Those are the women who love pregnancy.
That's going to be me. I feel like that's going to be me. So let's talk about gut health, because gut health can actually be a major contributor to this issue. So if you've got leaky gut, you have damage to the gut lining, and that's where you produce DAO, that function of that enzyme is going to be downregulated in the body a little bit. So can investigating and addressing some issues in the gut like significantly improve mast cell symptoms in most women?
Yes. Yeah. And yes, the short answer is yes. So we can expand on that a little bit. I mean, it's sort of two things going on in the gut. So there's the amount of DAO enzyme, which is affected by gut inflammation, and also just genetically, which variant of the DAO gene you have, which you can test, which is actually kind of an interesting test to do.
Yes.
Because some women just have that variant of the gene where they're going to tend to lower activity of the DAO enzyme, and that they're just like that from the beginning, so they're more vulnerable. Then inflammation can affect DAO. But the second thing is the mast cells themselves in the gut lining and how much they're being stimulated by dairy or other foods that are inflammatory for that person. Also, there's a question, very little doubt in my mind, that all various microbes are having different effects on both mast cells and DAO in the gut. So, you know, I don't know if we know the answer to all of that in terms of which bugs or, are causing a problem. Certainly there's quite a few companies now that have probiotic supplements, which they, you know, claim are histamine degrading, or probiotics that promote the reduction of histamine. Some probiotics increase histamine in the gut. So that is something to be aware of. That's the group of people who might feel worse from certain probiotics.
With lots of lactobacillus species, those lactobacillus buggies, those don't feel very good on a histamine full gut.
No. And the histamine kind of mast cell response can be diarrhea. That's probably the most common one. Actually, other signs of just high histamine or mast cell activation. So diarrhea, fluid retention, low blood pressure, which is an interesting one, which I've often, over all these years clinically, I'm like, yeah, there's this group of women who tend to have lower blood pressure, and they've got these other immune things going on, and try to tie it all together. I think that's part of it. And that's part of the connection. Did you have low blood pressure, or do you have low?
I have periodically had low blood pressure for no reason at all. I went through a period of high blood pressure when I was a little bit younger, but then as I've kind of progressed into this autoimmune state unknowingly, I did have more low blood pressure readings. Yeah, actually, I think the last one Haley took on me was low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a few months ago.
I actually see that a lot in my patients, these blood pressures around like 96 over 56 or something like that. It's pretty low. And so that is interesting. I always kind of associate it with like a HPA axis dysfunction.
Yes.
But having some type of idea that it might be a histamine.
I think it could be different things. It's not that cookbook. It's not like, oh, that always means histamine or mast cell, but I think it could be in there. And it's always interesting because patients will say, I've got this really low blood pressure. And I'm thinking, okay, that's important to know. That might be part of the picture, part of the concern. And yet the message they've always had is, oh, I've always just been told it's a really good thing. Like, you know, they'll check your blood pressure. It's like, it's low. Oh, that's really good. Because high is bad. Therefore, really low must be
like cholesterol,
or the better.
As low as you could possibly go, except for when you end up with degenerative brain disease later in life.
And with blood pressure, as low as you go until you faint, and like that's not
well, like dizziness on standing, which is like something that we associate with adrenal dysfunction, that you know, that can be involved as well. And I think part of that is also because histamine is inflammatory. Cortisol is anti-inflammatory. When you're stimulating inflammation in your body with this histamine response, you are putting more demand on your adrenal glands to deal with that inflammation, because the body doesn't want to be inflamed, and it's going to do what it needs to do to try to bring you back to homeostasis. And that can have a detrimental impact on other systems in the body.
Absolutely. And just actually just on the topic of HPA axis and the nervous system and the brain, you know, that's important for stabilizing mast cells as well. So we do, I mean, there's a bit of feedback going back and forth as always. But we have something called, which I've been into for a while, but I just love mentioning it, the vagus nerve, which is our parasympathetic response. So if you get that kind of calming message from the brain that all is well, that can also help to stimulate mast cells. So you can come at it from different angles.
So helping reduce stress, manage stress, maybe through like yoga or journaling or meditation, is another way to deal with, you know, PMS or irritation or all these symptoms that they might be experiencing with mast cell degranulation.
Yes,
right. Yeah,
and it's working via different ways. But you know that, you know, the vagus nerve is like our it's like our anti-inflammatory button. It's like we have a button. It's like, you know, it's like the button on it
set. Right.
Mm-hmm. Boost inflammation throughout the whole body, stimulate the vagus nerve.
Do that in a lot of really interesting ways, like
weird
gargling until you bring tears to your eyes, or singing
cold, in the shower,
cold water on your face.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that was one.
Cold, like a splash of cold water, bitter tastes, slow.
That's why, like hot and cold contrast baths are good, because it stimulates the vagus nerve.
So
many interesting things.
We're nerding out so hard right now.
Running through my mind right now as we're chatting about this. So let's talk diet, because diet is obviously a big piece of this. And, you know, there are lots of different, you know, food lists out there of what to avoid if you have mast cell activation or you're struggling with histamine. But I think there's like a baseline list of things that you would want to take out right away. So cow dairy is coming out. Yeah. What are some of the other things?
Alcohol.
Oh yeah. Red wine in particular.
So I just say alcohol generally, not friendly to the gut. You know, we all talk about intestinal permeability and all, but you know that alcohol is one of the things that worsens permeability more than anything.
Not only that, it transports LPS across the gut lining.
Exactly. So. It causes what's called endotoxemia. Mm-hmm. So somehow alcohol got a free pass. I'm not sure how that happened, but
because it's culturally ingrained.
Yeah. So all alcohol potentially has a mast cell stimulating or kind of histamine response, but certainly some alcohol, like wines, actually many of the beverages contain histamines as well. So that's why they aggravate migraines, all the typical kind of, well, some of the migraine triggers are histamine foods. Then I guess the food next on the list for me, for my patients, would be the fermented foods. So, which is important because we're in this era of, you know, fermented foods, which are great. I mean, I've always loved sauerkraut. You know, yes, they're good, but I think for some people,
they don't work.
No, having that daily, especially, and having it more than just a little condiment, which it was supposed to be, but having like a half a cup of sauerkraut every day, that's not potentially helping things, especially if there's histamine symptoms. People can feel a lot better when they stop those foods. So also things like canned fish.
Yeah.
What else should be on the list? Yeah.
Kombucha is like the health craze these days. And oh my God, kombucha makes me feel so disgusting. Like I love it because it's nice to drink something other than water, but I cannot have kombucha around ovulation. I cannot have it when I'm kind of in that stage of the second half of my cycle where my symptoms are, you know, right there. Like they're ready to go. Those mast cells are ready to go. And I can't, I have to be really careful with diet.
That's really interesting, that just for the listeners to try to understand, is that what Kristen's saying is that sometimes during her cycle, kombucha is fantastic. And then other times during her cycle, it causes her all these symptoms. And so that could be really confusing if you're not highly aware of where you're at in your cycle, or if you are understanding this, you know, cyclic symptoms that you're having. Yeah. And so just, you know, if you're wondering like, I do great some days and then other days I do crappy on this food and now I'm really confused. Track your cycle, track your symptoms, and then start tracking your food and in the relation to your cycle, which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. And, you know, the other thing that I want to mention is the amount of frustration that can come about when you have a histamine issue, whether it's an issue clearing histamine or whether it's a mast cell activation type of situation. You can think that you are literally sensitive to everything that you eat. Mm-hmm. And histamine is different than a typical food sensitivity where your body is actually like forming antibodies to a protein or something in a food. Histamine is different. It's like a bucket. I was just explaining this actually to a client that I met with this morning who we're suspecting some histamine stuff for. And histamine's like a bucket, and you can fill up the bucket. So like maybe you can tolerate having a high histamine fruit like an avocado. And you can have that in the morning, but then you had some kombucha for lunch. And then by the time you got to like having a soup full of bone broth with a little bit of fermented food for dinner, then your histamine bucket overflows and you start getting symptoms later in the day. Does that mean that you're sensitive to bone broth or some like beef or whatever that you made the bones from? No, it doesn't. It means that you overflowed your bucket for that day. So it's not like you're reacting necessarily to specific components in food. You just can't tolerate that buildup of histamine.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to describe it. And it depends on where you are in your cycle. Just as you said, like early follicular, you could probably tolerate a lot more histamine or mast cell stimulating foods than you can at ovulation or during PMS. And it is very important to make this distinction. So I'll just kind of repeating what you just said, but just in other words, we have all these different food rules, and some people need to avoid, we're talking about, you know, mast cell stimulating foods. Some people need to avoid gluten. So just make a compare and contrast to that. So with some people, if they truly have a gluten issue, which is not everyone, I mean, just to point out too, that not everyone who, you know, has a problem with wheat has a problem with gluten. As you know, gluten is a very specific kind of sensitivity. For that kind of sensitivity, there often needs to be complete avoidance, which is a very different situation than what we're talking about here with these foods, where we're basically saying to dial them up and dial them down, depending on where you're at and how much you've had that day. So they're not problematic foods in the same way, as you pointed out, that certain proteins are when you form an immune response.
Right. Yeah. For the longest time, I just thought that I was like allergic to avocados, and I'm like, no, right, I'm not.
Actually. Oh, you're not.
Yeah. I remember going this last year on this journey with you of trying to figure out what the heck is happening, and you developing this whole idea around, the mast cell degranulation and histamine response. And it's been really awesome to see how your diet has been able to be more varied, and you've been able to eat more things because now you completely understand like what's actually happening.
It's really important, actually. And this could be some listeners who might be thinking, wow, yeah, I thought I was allergic to this whole list of foods, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I just need to be careful with the amount or work to stabilize, you know, the immune system and help with my gut and DAO clearance. And then might be able to eat some of those foods again. Great. Doesn't it always feel good when you can, with a patient, bring foods back rather than restrict foods?
It's the best, especially for fertility, because you really need to be eating the most varied diet that you can tolerate, because you need all of the different nutrients that you're getting in that variety of foods. Particularly with fruits and vegetables, you know, the different antioxidants and phytonutrients and things that you're getting, super important to have variety in the diet.
Definitely.
Yeah. Definitely.
So I think we're probably kind of coming to a close here. I feel like we just talked for 5 minutes and yet it's been like 50 minutes.
Yeah, it's been great.
Isn't that crazy?
So let's kind of summarize some of the recommendations. So we've given listeners a lot of information about kind of what's going on, what they might notice if they're experiencing problems with histamine, what some of the contributing factors are. So let's kind of give a summary of like what to do, like first steps, what to think about. Just kind of put it in a nice little box with a bow for everybody.
It's a good goal. It's a complex topic to do that with. But yes, one thing I want to say before we get to the little tying up everything with a bow, the other group of people who can really encounter unexpected histamine mast cell symptoms is menopause, perimenopause, menopause, because something definitely shifts with, you'd think having lower estrogen would mean, okay, suddenly you're free of those symptoms. But actually for some women, there's what are called menopausal allergies, which flare up, which I think it's just the recalibration of the whole immune system that happens. So I'm just mentioning that in case, I know you guys are a fertility podcast, so you might not have any late 40 something women listening.
Hey, it's helpful for me.
Hey, and you know, we all have mothers, right? Like we all have,
exactly.
We all have moms.
We can think about that. Well, I think hormone replacement therapy in menopause is also an interesting indication. If you get symptoms after starting an estrogen type of medication, that might be an indication that you have something going on with your histamine.
Bingo. Exactly what you just said. Those women who react kind of quite strongly or almost violently to estrogen supplement is usually, I'd say, a mast cell situation. Or that they are given too much. But yes, it's different than that. So, all right. Like a step one is to not be intimidated by, if this sounds kind of sciencey, just step one is just to think, wait, okay, am I having these what seem like immune type symptoms? You know, heat, hives, headachy, that fluctuate with my cycle? Because if the answer is yes, then it's time to look beyond just hormones and actually think about this aspect of the immune system. And then the next step would be to take some simple steps. I think the next step would be to try coming off dairy and just see, give that a good, as you say, Haley, maybe a couple months, just to see how much relief that can bring. And that's, you know, somewhat confirming. I guess the other way to confirm is you could, maybe speaking with your clinician, you could, you know, trial an antihistamine, over-the-counter antihistamine, just to see, just to check in as like, oh, how much relief does that give me from these symptoms? And then you've got some of that information. And then you can progress just sensibly to the next steps you can take to stabilize things, stabilize the mast cells. One might be, if you've been reacting badly to a probiotic, stop that probiotic. If you're having, if you're drinking tons of kombucha and fermented foods, just stop that. Take a break. And, you know, then you can look at some of the supplements. We talk about vitamin B6, can really, I think it's my favorite. We didn't mention quercetin, but it's probably worth being in the conversation. That's one of those, a supplement that can stabilize mast cells, reduce histamine. And yeah, I guess cut alcohol. Think about at least not having the wine, or at least not having wine during those high estrogen or kind of estrogen dominant times of the cycle. Yeah.
It's not a great thing to consume in the fertility context anyway.
No.
I feel like this is an easier one since we already talk about why it's important to eliminate alcohol, or at least reduce it significantly so that you're not drinking on any sort of a regular basis.
You know what, guys? I actually think we should be having no alcohol. I mean, I say that even though I do have the occasional drink myself, but it's, we've been sold a bill of goods with this whole, like, wine is healthy. Alcohol is not healthy for women or men, but particularly for women in so many ways, not just the histamine context, but much bigger. And actually back to perimenopause briefly, which is obviously where some of my interest lies. There's a lot of alcohol craving happening during that time, can be. And that's actually one of the worst times to have alcohol. Not just because of this histamine thing, but because of other reasons.
So. Yeah, you know, I've actually found that clients, and I've actually noticed this in myself too, like getting super in tune with my body and like what foods I'm craving. A lot of times I actually crave foods that are high in histamine. And I wonder if what I'm actually craving is like the cortisol hit. Like I'm craving the high from what I'm like, the cortisol, the release that I'm getting from consuming something like that. Because when I feel crappy and I'm like low, I'm like, oh, I want to go grab something like a kombucha, not for the little bit of caffeine or whatever that's in the tea, but because I feel like it's like a pick me up. It's an awake, you know, and I want that during the day. Obviously I don't want to be up all night. So
no, there's something to that. I mean, these are all foods are, I mean, what we're describing now is the way foods in different ways affect brain chemistry, and absolutely makes sense. We can become sort of addicted to that
Yeah, just another thing, right?
I know.
To deal with. Oh man, I love sharing all my messed up stuff on the podcast. I'm like a little guinea pig for all the things that we get to investigate and explore and talk about on the podcast with more knowledgeable people than us on these subjects. So I think that's going to do it for today, Dr. Laura Friedan. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about this somewhat complex science-y topic and really breaking it down.
Yeah. You did a really good job of breaking it down and making it approachable to the listeners. And I feel like they're going to get a lot out of this episode. I know I definitely did. And hopefully we can have you back on to talk about more awesome subjects. You're just a wealth of knowledge and you're very passionate about women's health and And you can share a lot of that knowledge with our listeners.
Thank you guys. It's always lovely chatting with you. Yeah, it was a good conversation. And I'm sure there's a few people out there now having little light bulb moments thinking, yeah, I need
to yes, we look hope at so.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Yeah, take care.
All right, that's going to wrap up today's episode. Thanks so much for listening. We hope that you learned a lot from Dr. Bryden. She's a wealth of knowledge. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating or a review on iTunes. It only takes a minute and it seriously makes our day to hear from you. Lastly, remember that there's only 1 week to jump in on our brand new online course with that $100 off. So go to the episode description notes, get the last chance promo code, and join the class before the end of day on Wednesday, October 2nd. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you back next week.